Buenas tardes, buenas noches, señoras y señores, queridos amigos, dear Mr. Ambassador, dear Mr. Nick. Voy a tomar la palabra muy brevemente para hacer de maestro de ceremonias de esta inauguración o de esta celebración, de esta inauguración de nuestra exposición Joseph Albers, Medios Mínimos, Efecto Máximo, que se inaugura hoy y estará hasta el mes de julio. La exposición, como muchos de ustedes seguro que ya saben y quizás incluso la han visto, ha sido organizada, ha sido concebida y organizada en estrecha colaboración con la Joseph y Annie Albers Foundation de Bethany, Connecticut, y hoy nos acompaña su espíritu rector, Nicholas Fox Weber, al que voy a ceder la palabra inmediatamente porque se hará cargo de la lectura que centra este acto de presentación. Después hay un programa musical preparado por el Departamento de Actividades Culturales de la Fundación, al violín y al piano. Tienen ustedes en un tríptico muy parecido a la invitación a este acto el programa musical completo con las notas al programa y la descripción de las piezas de John Cage, Maurice Ravel y Pablo Sarasate, con la que terminaremos este acto. Después habrá tiempo también para ver la exposición. La exposición, como habrán visto, es una retrospectiva. Quiere decir que hay obras del Albers inicial, de sus primeros dibujos, hasta el final, hasta los homenajes al cuadrado de los años 70. Y, sin embargo, es más que el resultado de haber conseguido, gracias a la generosidad de muchos prestadores. Voy a evitar referirme a todos ellos, porque nuestro departamento de multimedia ha tenido durante 3 minutos la lista completa de prestadores y agradecimientos, si no sería muy engorroso. Sin el préstamo de muchas instituciones, la exposición no hubiera sido posible. Me gustaría destacar que hemos podido traer a Madrid piezas muy relevantes de Albers procedentes de las colecciones del Guggenheim y el Met, de la colección del Museo Hirshhorn de Washington, del Museo de Yale y de muchísimas colecciones, la Tate, el Pompidou en Europa y de muchísimas colecciones públicas y privadas. Decía que uno puede hacerse una idea muy exacta de quién fue Joseph Albers, porque es una retrospectiva, pero no es simplemente una retrospectiva. Hay como dos aspectos que hemos querido destacar. Una es su labor, o mejor dicho, su vocación temprana. Fue maestro de escuela, antes que artista, de Joseph Albers, en su Bottrop natal, en la cuenca del Ruhr. Joseph Albers empezó dando clases en secundaria y solo más adelante se matriculó en la Bauhaus, en la que fue alumno, después profesor, colega y compañero de Oscar Schlemmer, de Paul Klee, al que hemos dedicado una exposición muy recientemente, de Lionel Feininger o de Vasily Kandinsky. Y después, cuando tiene que huir o marcharse a América, Albers forma parte de el que es, junto con la Bauhaus, probablemente el segundo experimento de pedagogía del arte más interesante del siglo XX, como es Black Mountain College, en Carolina del Norte, en los Estados Unidos. Su faceta de profesor está muy presente en la exposición, y también su faceta procesual, el trabajo o el proceso de trabajo que Albers emprendía en su pintura y también en su labor docente. La exposición tiene un título, cuanto menos, llamativo: Medios Mínimos, Efecto Máximo. Recuerda al menos es más, recuerda también por la admiración que tenía Albers por el trabajo manual y por el dominio del oficio al Dios está en los detalles de Mies van der Rohe, último director de la Bauhaus, persona muy cercana también a Albers, y recuerda pues algunas formulaciones de lo que podríamos llamar la economía, ¿no? Exprimir los recursos para sacarles el máximo partido. Cuando yo estaba en el colegio, supongo que muchos de ustedes me enseñaron una definición de economía que no se me ha olvidado, que es aquella que reza: la economía es la administración de recursos escasos susceptibles de usos alternativos, ¿no? Pues hay una economía que es esa, que es la economía del dinero, del intercambio de bienes, pero hay también otras economías mucho más profundas que la del dinero, que la del mero intercambio de bienes materiales, y una de ellas, obviamente, es la del arte, en la que la frase es aplicable, pero con matices. Y quizás el artista al que esa frase es más aplicable, tanto en su reflexión teórica como en su propia práctica artística, sea Joseph Albers. Esos matices son que, en el caso del arte, los recursos que hay que administrar no son precisamente escasos. Al principio del trabajo del artista, las posibilidades potenciales de hacer cosas son infinitas o casi infinitas. Pero, en consecuencia, los usos alternativos que se pueden dar a esas infinitas posibilidades potenciales son también interminables o infinitas. De manera que el artista siente, en algunos casos con mucho dolor, que en cada paso tiene que tomar decisiones que... La decisión básica que está en la base de cualquier economía, que es siempre la de elegir entre lo valioso y lo menos valioso, entre el fin y los medios. Albers hizo de esta máxima, de sacar el máximo partido a los medios mínimos, algo así como el santo y seña de su creación. Y no por eso, no en vano, es uno de los principales pintores de la abstracción moderna, porque en el fondo la abstracción, que como saben ustedes, pues ha ocupado la corriente central del arte moderno, es básicamente un procedimiento económico. Cuando se hace abstracción, lo que se hace es, como decía Fernando Zóbel, sobrar lo que quita, o liberar al arte, o, si no quieren que use la palabra liberar, depurar al arte de todos los conceptos de gasto que arrastraba durante toda su historia. Pues las deudas con la representación de la realidad, la imitación, el color, la limitación de los soportes o del marco. Albers hace eso de una manera extraordinariamente, con una enorme maestría, y por eso cuando Nicolas Fox Weber sugirió que quizás ese era, junto al aspecto pedagógico y al aspecto del proceso de trabajo, la manera más limpia de entrar al proyecto expositivo, nos pusimos al trabajo y el resultado es la exposición. De alguna manera, con el arte pasa como en aquella parábola de la multiplicación de los panes y de los peces, que en algún momento ocurre un milagro que acaba con las leyes de la naturaleza, la rompe, y de unos pocos panes y unos pocos peces, de unas pocas posesiones materiales, resulta que come mucha gente, ¿no? Pero a diferencia de ese episodio, no ocurre que cuando se consumen los muchos panes y peces producidos, aquello se acaba, porque se destruye, porque es consumido y digerido, sino que esos extraños objetos materiales, estos fascinantes objetos materiales que son las obras de arte, por mucho que se las consuma, obviamente con ese tipo de consumo tan particular, que es la contemplación, con el que no se las destruye, se multiplican, no se acaban nunca, ¿no? También por eso hemos colocado la exposición, además, si la han visto, hemos querido mantenerla incluso en la instalación expositiva en este ambiente de austeridad. No hay cartelas, apenas hay más color que el blanco y el gris, hay unas pocas frases, una de ellas es un texto, un poema, en realidad, de Albers, que dice distribuir las posesiones materiales es dividirlas, distribuir las posesiones espirituales es multiplicarlas. Estamos muy satisfechos de que durante 3 meses seamos los receptáculos o los guardianes de las posesiones materiales de Joseph Albers, porque estamos seguros de que su efecto se va a multiplicar en forma de contemplación, de goce estético y de aprendizaje para las personas que nos visiten. Habrán visto ustedes que la Fundación también ha editado un catálogo en 2 ediciones, en castellano y en inglés, en la que hemos podido dedicar un apartado muy amplio a una antología de textos de Albers que muchos de ellos estaban inéditos, incluso en inglés, algunos solo editados en alemán o ni siquiera editados, muchos de ellos absolutamente maravillosos y que delatan pues, la profundidad de la vida y la obra de arte de Albers. Perdón. Por último, quería recordarles que, aparte del concierto de hoy, la Fundación ha organizado un ciclo de conferencias, la primera de ellas sobre Albers. La primera de ellas la impartirá José Francisco Ibars, historiador del arte, crítico, profesor, exdirector del IBAM, editor de la revista Calías, que conoció a Albers personalmente. La segunda, la doctora Laura Martínez de Guereño, que ha sido pues, digamos, el alma de la selección de textos y del apartado documental de nuestro catálogo, que centrará su conferencia sobre el año 29, un año esencial en la vida de Albers y en el que casualmente, junto con Kandinsky y Klee, bordea nuestro país y recala en San Sebastián. Tenía bastante gusto al elegir las ciudades, ¿no? Muy bien. Y por último, déjenme que dedique un par de palabras a Nicolas Fox Weber, que ha sido la fuerza motora de este proyecto. Nicolas es el director ejecutivo de la Fundación Joseph y Annie Albers en Bethany, Connecticut. Conoció y trabajó algunos años con Joseph Albers y con Annie Albers. Fue el comisario de la exposición que dedicó en los años 80 la antológica de Albers en el Guggenheim, y estaba ya con Joseph Albers cuando, y esto me parece importante decirlo, el Metropolitan de Nueva York le dedicó una retrospectiva que ha sido la primera retrospectiva que ese gran museo dedicó a un artista vivo. Nicolas Fox Weber no es solo un gran conocedor de la obra de arte, de Albers, perdón, no es solo, casi son sinónimos, decían, no es solo el director ejecutivo de la Fundación, es además un reconocidísimo escritor que publica en una de las mejores editoriales norteamericanas, la serie de Borzoi Books de Farrar, Straus & Giroux, y tiene escritas maravillosas biografías que no puedo menos que recomendar sobre Le Corbusier, Balthus y algunas figuras de la cultura norteamericana. Y este proyecto no hubiera sido posible sin él y con su equipo, Brenda Danilovitz, y sin su equipo, como Brenda Danilovitz, Sam McKeown, Janet Redensek, y sin la fuerza de Nick, que es un auténtico atleta del mundo del arte. Les dejo con él y les pido un aplauso para él. Muchas gracias.
We know him as the painter of squares. And the squares, of course, are part of the great reputation of Joseph. And this exhibition brings together some of the most beautiful ones that have ever been shown and presented side by side. But, and I want to ask first, is the translation working? Okay, great. And miking as well. And I want to get right to a point that I by no means had expected to discuss tonight. Joseph used to talk about thinking in situations, allowing the unexpected to happen. The exhibition that you have seen or are about to see ends with a painting called Glow, one of the most beautiful homages to the square that belongs to the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington. And it was used as the image on a U.S. postage stamp for which the brought out by the Department of Education, for which the slogan was Learning Never Ends. Well, this evening, I had the experience of going through the exhibition with two of your greatest architects, Juan Navarro Baldeveig and Rafael Moneo, neither of whom I had ever met before. It was magic to be looking at Joseph's work with these two men who were so respectful, so receptive to what they were looking at, was simply perfect evidence that learning never ends. Juan spoke to me about the way that there is really no illusion in art, that everything takes place at once, everything is right, and this is something that I hope you will feel when looking at the show, and that Joseph felt with the squares, that learning simply never ends. Now, he was a very practical man. He told me that he painted the squares the way that he spread butter on bread, period. And he always started in the center and worked his way out because his father taught him that when you paint a door, you start in the center, you work your way out, that way you catch the drips of paint and you don't get your cuffs dirty. Very practical. He worked on solid white masonite panels, which allowed color to sing as powerfully as it could. He called these paintings platters to serve color, and he made miraculous things happen. For example, look at the one on the right. He would say, it's midnight and noon at the same time. This is what you get in art, not the realities of everyday life, but the particular world of art. Now, in the exhibition, you'll see his great publication, Interaction of Color. I'm very aware this evening, because we're graced by the presence of the American ambassador, and very aware that he and his partner are working with the Art and Embassies program on having Joseph's work here in Madrid. Interaction of Color was first shown by the woman who started the Art and Embassies program, an ambassador's wife, Mrs. Llewellyn Thompson, Jane Thompson, who had it in Moscow, and described an evening to me when she arranged for corn on the cob to be flown in from Illinois, for Nina and Nikita Khrushchev, who had a hard time eating it, and then she showed Interaction of Color to everybody there. Because what Joseph demonstrated is universal, goes beyond all languages, all time periods, and all cultures. He demonstrated the different ways that we perceive color. So I would ask you to look at these two blocks of tan. They really don't look the same. They're identical. They are a continuation of the same color. I'm going back. Colors change according to their setting. The same color can be made to look different. Here, you have these two grids. The one on the left appears, to me, far lighter than the one on the right. They are made of the identical color. It looks different because of its surroundings. Now look at these X's. This one certainly looks more yellow than that one. Now, see the bottom line? The continuation, they are the same color. His paintings give great evidence of this exciting way that colors change and perception destabilizes us in a very exciting and thrilling way. I'm asking you, I'm counting on you, to do something here, which is please just focus on the black dot in the middle of this study of interaction of color on your left. Just focus on it. Look at nothing else. Just look at that black dot. Please continue looking till I ask you to do otherwise. You're looking, and only when I say three, I'm going to ask you to turn to your right and look at the other screen. One, two, three. Now, I assume that most of you saw the impression of yellow triangles. Or diamond shapes. Prior to this evening, I would have called it an illusion. But thanks to the wisdom of Mr. Baldweg, I'm not calling it an illusion. I'm recognizing that all of this is part of the experience of the retina and the human mind. So Joseph took these principles and applied them to the art of painting. Very simple language. He was so diligent. He didn't care about trends. He didn't care what was in, what was out, what was fashionable, what was expensive, what wasn't. Pop art, op art, abstract expressionism, it didn't interest him. What interested him was the purity of those squares and the wonder of color and the variations that he could get of color. Diligently, day after day, living simply, modestly, he painted squares, constantly pushing them in new directions. Please just look. I'm going never to show you the same painting twice. I just want you to enjoy his yellows and grays. I want you to pick your favorites. I want you to see the way that the motion changes when the colors change, even though you're always looking at what is factually the same painting. You certainly should have some that you prefer to others, some that work for you, some that don't. Joseph would sometimes vary a painting only by changing a Winsor Newton Mars yellow from a Grumbacher Mars yellow in the center of a painting. And with that subtle change, everything else seems to change. Diligence, variations. Creating a poetry from this very, very simple form of experimentation. Now, we live in a world where we're always rushing, always doing new things, looking for the latest kick, checking our cell phones. There's very little time just to observe. This morning, I was taking guides through this show, and I said, would they please make sure that people who come to this exhibition stop, Don't look for facts. Just look and observe. I'm going to ask you to look at these two homages to the square. If you were to describe them in words, you would be describing almost the same painting. You know, four squares going from oranges to a gray. The proportions are such that underneath the middle square, you have single units, double units to the left and right of it, triple units above it. Those are the facts. But look carefully, look at the differences, and then I'm going to ask you to look at the one on the left only, and you're going to hear about a minute of Beethoven's 14th string quartet performed by the Quartetto Italiano. Then you're going to look at the one on the right and listen to that same minute of music, but performed in an old recording by the Budapest. It's demanding. Look carefully, listen carefully. The same work of music, different performances. In many ways, the same painting, but different performances, different results, different emotions. And then there's the sheer pleasure. You're looking at four colors separately, but together. You're listening to four instruments separately, but together. You're looking at Albers and listening to Beethoven. Thank you. You see, wine connoisseurs will ask you to notice the difference between the 2003 vintage and the 2004, or what happens if you decant a wine or leave it open for 2 hours. Joseph wanted you to look at color that attentively and listen to music that attentively. He looked at all form with an idea of getting the maximum effect from minimal means. In your exhibition, you'll see his wonderful chair from the Bauhaus, which disassembled so that it could be shipped, a few elements perfectly put together. You'll see color studies, which show him constantly experimenting with materials. You'll see rare paintings like the one on the right called Cadence, which to my eye is an abstract form of something one sees in Piero della Francesca. In the Piero della Francesca Annunciation, you have the active form of the angel arriving and the more passive form of the Virgin. Look at Joseph's abstraction. You have an active form and a passive form. You never have paint on top of a paint. The translucency and transparency are illusory in that painting on the right. You have abstract qualities which have the restraint and the power and the grace of Piero. In 1947, he began to paint a group of paintings that he called the variants or the adobes. You have beauties in this exhibition because the people here at your wonderful museum have gone out of their way to collect masterpieces from all over the world. I'm asking you for a moment to look very closely at the one on your left and imagine a conversation I had with Joseph. He was 85, I was 25. The year was 1973 or 4. And he said to me, "Nick, which color do you see the most of in this painting? Do you see the most of the red, the blue, the purple, or the brown?" Now, he would say words are inadequate for describing colors, but remember, no color is painted on top of another. Each is paint straight from the tube. I'm asking you to look, and if you would, just call out your answer. In Spanish or English, what color is there the most of?
Red.
Joseph would say, you will certainly, in a crowd of people, have four different answers because we do not see colors in the same way. And then he said to me, there's an equal amount of each color. And Joseph explained to me, that's my madness, that's my craziness. But he loves systems. He loved order because order and discipline enabled him to create poetry. He liked the way that the blue doesn't look the same here as it looks here. If you think you see more red, it's the quality of red. And that's what he wanted you to grasp. Not the quality of Albers, not the person of Albers, but the quality of red. Universal truths. He wanted you to savor the movement. He wanted you to contemplate color quantity and light intensity. And then finally, he came to this beautiful language, 62 years old, simple, straightforward, monosyllabic language. Think of King Lear at the end of his life. All the pomp and ceremony are gone. He's reduced to the most refined language. It is Cordelia. Simple facts. Three squares. And with three squares, you can go so far. He saw blues and greens as beautiful in themselves, also as representing the land, the earth, and the cosmos. He loved the sunniness of yellows. He experimented and experimented. And now, listen to the song, "The Sunny Side of the Street," and feel the spirit of this one.
I walk with no one and talk with no one, and I had nothing but shadows. Then one morning you passed, then I brightened at last. Now I greet the day and complete the day with the sun in my heart. All my worries blew away when you taught me how to say, grab your coat and get your hat, leave your worries on the doorstep, and just direct your feet on the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? That little happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. Why should you walk in the shade with those blues on parade? Don't be afraid. Be a rover and walk over. And if you haven't got a cent, you'll be as rich as Rockefeller, with gold dust at your feet on the sunny side of the street. Grab your coat, get that old derby hat, leave all your worries laying right on your doorstep. Left, right, left, direct your feet on the sunny side of the street. Listen, can't you hear that little pitter-pat? Oh, that happy tune, that should be your step. 'Cause life can be oh so sweet on the sunny side of the street. Why should you walk in the shade with old blues on parade? Come on, folks, don't be afraid. Be a little rover and walk over. And if you haven't got a cent, what of it? My laugh, you're as rich as Rockefeller, with gold dust at your feet on the sunny side of the street.
You know, Annie and Joseph Albers were like the rest of us. They dealt with crises. In their cases, they dealt with war, they dealt with Nazism, they dealt with illness. But art was what put them on the sunny side of the street. They believed that it was the place where we can find serenity, balance, clarity, and joy. Even in the year that they fled to America, 1933, they created art that was technically rich, full of balance, the wonder of straight lines. And I was lucky enough to know Joseph toward the very end of his life. He was still robust and healthy. In January of 1976, when I arrived at his house one day, and I asked him, as always, "How are you, Mr. Albers?" And he said, "Schlecht. I'm having a difficult time today. I'm trying to do a painting, Nick, with a large central square. But to make it work, I need a particular paint, Winsor Newton Cobalt Green number 196. And if I try it with the new Cobalt Green number 205, downstairs is heaven, but upstairs is hell." He wasn't getting the interaction of color. And he said that the photographer Cartier-Bresson had told him that he painted circular squares, which meant that the corners disappear. And Joseph said to me that he was seeing the blue as the cosmos, the next color as the sea and the earth, and the next as the sea. And he was desperate for the right paint. That's what I mean by the attention to detail, the connoisseurship. I called every art supply store in Connecticut. We could not get that Winsor Newton Cobalt Green. I then called the head of the American branch. It's an English company. I called the head of the American branch. He said there was no difference in their batches of Cobalt Green. And I said, "I'm calling for Joseph Albers, sir." A few days later, 5 tubes of paint arrived in a box. Joseph painted this, and he said he had to paint the central square large because it was the cosmos, and he felt the cosmos was getting nearer. It was the last painting that he did, and as he said to me, the cosmos should have no boundaries, no edges, and no corners. He achieved that majesty in his work. I now want to take a moment and have the great pleasure of introducing you to great supporters of Joseph's work, Michael Smith and James Costos, the ambassador and partner who are here in Madrid, and who will conclude my talk with a few words, if you would please.
Thank you very much. I have no music, sadly, to accompany my remarks. I first want to thank Nick for what I think is an incredibly inspirational talk, and for his championship and his stewardship of the legacy of Joseph and Annie Albers. I come to you not just as a partner of an American ambassador, but also as a presidential appointee to something that's been around since 1962 called the Committee for the Preservation of the White House, which goal is to continue to add to the collection of the White House and expand its collection. And very kindly, Nick and the Foundation recently gave 2 works by Joseph Albers to the White House Permanent Collection. And it starts to expand the White House's collection beyond 18th, 19th, and early 20th century work, and starts to take it into a much more post-war modern era, which I think is incredibly appropriate given this president and what the White House is starting to, or it's continuing to stand for. The thing that I also want to talk about in gratitude to Joseph Albers is when I was a young arts student, one of the first purchases I made was Interaction of Color, and I still have my paperback book. It is the 50th anniversary of that book, which gives you some idea of my age. But the idea of it is that I found the concept, the idea of taking art and taking nothing from its beauty and its romance and its magic, but also giving the mind something to look at or to experience or to break down and digest, to have an understanding not just of what we see, but how we see it. And for us as Americans and for the world, it has been one of the most influential pieces of art education and education and inspiration. And also in our culture as well as the world, there is not a fashion designer, an artist, or a graphic artist who has not borrowed heavily and liberally from the work of Joseph Albers. I also want to take a moment to thank the Albers Foundation for a possible project we're going to work on, which will highlight and bring forth a piece for the White House related to the work of Annie Albers, who in her way was such an inspiration and such a incredible mind, not just artistically, but politically and socially. And later, after much suggestion from Nick, I really delved into and looked at her work and was captivated by not only its beauty, but its technical and sort of, you know, its advances in weaving, and it's sublime. It's extraordinarily beautiful if any of you have a chance to look at it. So I come with a very, very grateful heart and mind for this work, and I'm so extraordinarily thrilled that it's here in my new home, Madrid, and hopefully we'll all get to see it for a long time, and hopefully you'll bring more of the work back. I know there's another exhibition of Joseph's work in Palma in the summer, and we look forward to seeing that as well. But I can't think of an artist who more identifies the best of, he was German born, but we take him as our own, as the very best of American modernism and ingenuity, and thank you so much. Thank you.
There's a wonderful concert which will follow, including a performance of a piece that John Cage wrote for Joseph and Annie. He was a student at Black Mountain College. And I ask you, when you can, get to the exhibition, and enjoy that incredible treat that Joseph Albers wanted us all to have every day of our lives, the pleasure of seeing and the wonder of open eyes. Thanks.